How did we get to where we are in life, and what does food have to do with it? Welcome to Meat in My Kitchen, a podcast from my Berlin kitchen. I'm Maike Peters, and I meet chefs and home cooks who I find inspiring to talk about this question. Today I'm meeting Susan Choi from Mr. Susan. She owns one of Berlin's most acclaimed bars, creating cocktails that are surprisingly mind-blowing. Her family merges three cultures into one: Korean, German, American, the endless source of inspiration to feed Susan's mantra, life's a feast.
That's just really the moment where I was like, okay, it's time to jump ship. It's time to hang up the PowerPoint and pick up the knife kind of thing. My parents worked so hard for us, and it is the classic kind of immigrant story where, you know, your parents work like a bajillion jobs and a bajillion hours to make sure that you have like everything that you could want in the world. Every single opportunity that I have is really because of my parents.
All of my guests share a recipe with me, which you can find on maikepeters.com under Meat in Your Kitchen. For the Frühschoppen in this Meat in My Kitchen episode, a German tradition of drinking before noon, we fill our glasses with Spumante from Ferrari Trento. Katz Studios takes care that a podcast from my tiny kitchen sounds smooth and cozy. And the music is by Martin Stumpf. So let's start. Welcome to my Berlin kitchen. Susan, what was the first cocktail you ever had in your life?
So the crazy thing is, because in the States where I grew up, the legal drinking age is 21, and I was such that nerdy, follow the rules Asian kid. I literally didn't drink until I turned 21, and the first drink I ever had was a frozen strawberry margarita at my favorite Mexican restaurant in California.
I'm sure you had it on your birthday straight away.
I had it on my birthday, and I think I had like 7 of them.
How did that end?
I don't know. I'm still here, so that's a good thing.
My first one was a pina colada, and I was in the Caribbean. I was 19. I was there with my boyfriend then, and we had pina coladas for lunch every day. We barely ate anything for lunch. We always sat under palm trees and had pina colada. Yeah, pina colada. I still like it somehow.
Are you kidding me? I'll drink a strawberry margarita any day.
Yeah, but I think your choice was a bit more classy than mine. A pina colada is very, very sweet, sticky.
So is a strawberry margarita. Did I mention it was frozen?
Okay.
And it came in this giant glass. No, but I do. That's funny, though, because frozen strawberry margarita, pina coladas, those always tend to be like the entree drinks. No one's first drink is ever like an old-fashioned.
Okay.
Or at least I don't think so.
Yeah, anyway. I think because when you're younger, you like it when it's a bit sweeter, fruity.
Yeah,
that's how you usually start with
of course.
Alcohol.
So. But I grew up straight away. I mean, I think after the strawberry margarita, I went straight to a sidecar. Do you know sidecar?
No.
It's like the brandy or cognac version, I would say, of a margarita. But the only reason why I wanted to drink that was because still to this day, one of my favorite books is Auntie Mame, one of my favorite fictional characters. She has that awesome quote, and that quote is, "Life's a feast, and most sons of bitches are starving to death." And I remember I read that and I just thought that it's literally a quote that stuck with me forever. But Auntie Mame woke up every morning and her butler, Ito, I totally remember every detail, would bring a tray of sidecars. And that's what she would drink. You know, she was basically this fabulous alcoholic. and then that was my second drink.
That was it. And you were hooked? Or did you move away from the cocktails then to other drinks?
No, that really was, that strawberry margarita really kicked it off. But you know, I think also though, with the sidecar, it was less about, wow, I'm in love with this perfectly balanced cocktail of brandy and cognac. I didn't even know what brandy was or cognac. But the fact that it had so much meaning because of this book and this character and what she meant in life. I thought, I want all that too, and I will get that if I drink many sidecars, just like Auntie Mame.
Then I get her life.
Exactly. I want to be fabulous too at 21 with no money.
At least I have the cocktail.
Exactly.
So let's just just go back in time and start a bit earlier. The first time we met, you told me you were born in Germany, which I didn't know. And you were actually, you grew up very close to where I'm from, in North Rhine-Westphalia. It surprised me because I always saw you as this sparkly American who conquered the Berlin bar scene. And there isn't much Germanness in you, really.
So what are
your memories from this time in Germany? How old were you when you left, actually?
Six when I left. It's funny because I clearly have no... You look at me, you listen to me, there's no Germanness about me. But it's really funny because for me personally, I do kind of inherently feel in my DNA there is a Germanness. And I think a lot of that is because I have incredibly strong memories of my childhood. I remember a lot, smells, tastes. And I was born in a really small town called Boaken and then lived in a neighboring small town called Bocholt. And I kind of forgot the question, but I will say...
Your memories. But you're doing it. Yes,
oh, I'm on the right track.
You're already right there. So your memories from this time.
I just have really, really great, solid, happy, positive memories. And a lot of it is because I call them my family. They're not blood family, but I literally grew up with them, and they are still one of my fondest memories. I think of them as family, but they're my godparents that basically were like my grandmother, my grandfather, and then their extended family also kind of became my family. I still call them Uncle Jupp and Tante Liesel. So I have amazing memories of... You know, food, of course. I have amazing memories of being in the garden. And everything was also very fresh, like picking berries from the garden. There were always beautiful flowers. I don't know. So there is a part of me... Oh, there was always cafe and kuchen at 4 o'clock. I loved going to the ice cafe in the middle of town. I always got heiße Kirsche, you know, when they pour the hot sour cherries on vanilla ice cream.
Do you know spaghetti ice?
I always got spaghetti ice. Exactly.
We have to explain it now. It's vanilla ice cream pressed in a way that it's shaped
like spaghetti.
And then you have strawberry sauce for the tomato sauce. And white chocolate,
yes.
Grated white chocolate replace the Parmesan. And it was such a big thing in the 80s. It's coming back now.
Is it? I'm so happy because you know what? I will tell you, that's something every time I go to Bocholt, go to the same ice cafe, I still get the spaghetti ice or the heiße Kirsche at the same places.
The funny thing is with the ice cafe is that... there was a change because the usual sundaes, you call it an ice sundae, what we call an ice becher is, I think, in English,
like
you call
it
a sundae.
It
used to be plain ice cream, whipped cream, and some kind of sauce and some sprinkles or a caramel, but it wasn't very fancy. And in the last year, few years or decades, in the last 10 years maybe, we got that wave from America maybe where you had pretzel, bacon, smoked whatever, vanilla ice cream, everything became a lot of different flavors came in, and that changed the ice culture in Germany a lot. So a lot of these traditional the compositions or the recipes you had in Italian style ice cafes here changed to more American style fancy wild flavor combinations, and now it's kind of coming back a little bit.
Well, I'm happy for spaghetti ice to come back.
Yeah,
I can still taste it, you know? And there's for some reason, I think the Italian ice cafes there were so many of them. There's a certain flavor. And you know how people always say flavor, smell is so much related to memory. And it's so true because there's a specific taste that the vanilla ice cream has and a texture that always brings me back to my childhood, which is why I still eat spaghetti ice today because it's such good memories.
Which I found out later, one of the reasons why the texture is so great because they shoot whipped cream inside. So it actually has a center of whipped cream. So there's whipped cream, vanilla ice cream around it. So That the, I think the whipped cream, it's always fat. The fat is a secret.
Oh, what a surprise.
It's always the food. But it's funny. So it's circling a lot about, as always, the food memories you had from that time. And the people, you mentioned the people. Did you speak German?
German was my first language, which is a shocker for everyone, even myself sometimes. So German was my first language. My parents also spoke German, which is crazy. And the even crazier thing is my mom still speaks to me in German, but I answer in English. Mm-hmm.
But she talks in German to you.
She speaks in German, and she's like also super into Facebook now. So she posts her comments on every single post that I have in German.
In German.
With sprinkles of English, which is really funny.
But yeah. Your mother came to Germany, I think, 20 years before you were born. So she came here in the 60s?
She came in the 60s. I'm not exactly sure when, what the math is. But my mom lived here for a long time, yeah. So she definitely came in the 60s, 100%.
What was her motivation to come to Germany? She came from Korea?
She came from Korea, and Korea had just gotten out of the war. And at that time, obviously there was not a lot of opportunity in Korea, especially for women. And I think my mom had a lot of potential, and I think her family saw that. And church saw that or whatever. So they raised money for my mother to be able to have the opportunity to come to Germany because there was like an exchange at that time for nurses and something like that. And at the same time too, I think my mom has always been super progressive. It's just inherently in her nature, which is where I feel like I get a lot of that from too. But she also was like, I'm not gonna make kimchi for the rest of my life and bring my husband slippers every night. I'm going to Germany, wherever that is.
And what did she do? What did she do? Did she study? Did she work right away? What did she do?
So I have to say, I think my mom is really cool. She's really awesome. I love my mom so much, not just, of course, because she's my mom, but she came and she conquered is basically the way I like to see it. She came here, she studied, she became a nurse, but she also saw other opportunities and she really followed her heart, and which led her to being a social worker. And that basically was her main kind of gig. But even as a nurse, she immediately worked for Charité. She was like the first woman ever within the hospital organization to be given a car. So like all these like little cool things that happened when my mom was here. It's just, I could write a book about it. But she then started to get more into social work because there was a lot of migration already starting to happen with Koreans coming to Germany. Of course, there's a huge Turkish population. And my mom worked really hard in those days to work around migration, immigration, and just helping those that had migrated to really kind of assimilate into Germany. So she basically would help other Koreans then, to be able to assimilate into German society and culture.
But that must have been quite a step for her family. It's quite a modern step in those days to just in the 60s say, we're going to send our daughter to that country that she can follow her dream at a time where women all over the world still had to struggle quite a lot to live their dreams. So it's
absolutely. And but I think it's kind of trickles down in my family because my grandmother was also a really, 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 really tough, strong woman, escaped from North Korea with all the kids, including my mom. And there's like many of them, 7 of them. How many brothers and sisters does my mom have? Anyway, there's many. 7? 8? Anyway, she schlepped them all on a secret boat, my grandmother by herself with nothing. And my mom tells a story that she sewed like gold pieces into their diapers because once you got on the boat, they took all your belongings away from you, any money or anything that you had. So she put jewels and gold into the diapers of my mom and her brothers and sisters. And then, then she's in South Korea by herself with all of her kids and nothing, and then built like this textile empire.
It sounds like you grew up in quite a matriarchal world within a very patriarchal, because the Korean culture is,
absolutely.
I think it's a very patriarchal culture. But it feels like your universe verse was always very female.
It was. And in retrospect, I kind of realize that now and how it kind of all trickles down. At the same time, though, I will say I still am very much like those other Korean kids, Korean American kids, where sometimes you're just like, oh my gosh, these Korean mom, it's called the Korean umma thing. Because they still tend to be quite conservative, regardless of how, even though my mom is so progressive, that old school Korean patriarchal kind of society is still, it's still in their blood in a way, you know. And it takes another generation to kind of change all those things too.
But so it feels like as soon as they have the chance to kind of free themselves, they're going to grab it. Like you showed me the news article with your mother. I think she was a member of this feminist group within a German political party. And
isn't
when
that
you
crazy?
Showed me that, this is so, yeah, because it's I love to hear these stories because these stories in our days are already great. But I mean, when women did that in the 60s, they had to fight against so much. There was this whole male system that they had to kind of crack open and yeah. find their way through.
I mean, it's incredible. We have, obviously, you and I, we have a lot of conversations being in our generation in terms of what it means to be a woman, especially working in gastronomy, and what it means to be a feminist and all of that. But I do. I think about my mom a lot because she did. She fought for women's emancipation in a country that wasn't hers, you know? So she was a foreigner and female. And, you know, sometimes she tells stories where she's like, oh, as a nurse, I cried so much because, well, number one, she really missed Korean food and there was nothing back then. But one of the stories that always sticks with me, and she goes, oh, people were so mean because they would tell, you know, the German nurses, I don't want the smelly Korean nurse because she smells like garlic and it's really bothering me and making me sick. So she would go home and cry, you know, and part of that then became, you know, so then when other Korean people came to be nurses, she'd be like, okay, chill out on the garlic and the kimchi because the Germans don't like it. So that it's really interesting that like that is also part of her.
But it's horrible. I mean, she had to deal with very brutal racism, and the reaction then was to kind of use or to kind of offer as little surface as possible where Germans can kind of pick on, which is quite... Which is horrible to and it's understandable, but it's also horrible to feel and to think like this.
Yeah.
Did she give that pass that on to you? Did she also give you the feeling adapt rather than fight? And I'm not saying she because this woman, your mother, fought a lot to get where she was, but did she teach you to fight for yourself?
I think 100% inherently she did, but I think there's a lot of factors at play, right? Because there's a whole thing about being a model minority, right? Especially with that with my parents' generation, where, and you know, I think about my parents and they were immigrants twice, right? They immigrated basically to Germany and then they were immigrants again in the United States. And I think with my parents' generation, there is kind of this, there is 100% this kind of ideology that you be quiet, you put your head down, and you're a model minority because then that way you will be accepted by white people, basically, ultimately, if I just say it straight up. So there was a lot of that instilled in us, like don't, you know, of course kids would pick on us, you know, and things like that. And my parents weren't really like, don't, you know, don't fight back or, you know, don't, they also didn't really have the vocabulary or the vernacular to really teach us that back then. But on the flip side of things, I do think that it runs in our blood, the Choi family blood a little bit too, to be outspoken, to chase your dreams, to be tough and to be strong. Like, I think all of that is kind of within us. But we weren't really taught that because that wasn't the way back then. And I think it's interesting to see my mom evolve now too, even though she was here fighting for women's emancipation and all those things. She has become, she was very vocal, especially for back then. But I think she's even becoming more vocal now because number one, we're just having more conversations about it. You know what I mean? More conversations around everything, you know, race, gender, the food we eat, which is exactly why we're here now within food culture and drink culture. Yeah.
Is this experience that you had then as a child in Germany and then later when you went to America, is a big part of your strength, because you're a very strong woman, do you think that the big part of your strength comes from this? But you said it's in the family blood as well. But this experience of having to fight every day, having to deal with also with people who were maybe as a child you already noticed, it doesn't help much when I explain them the whole situation now. So you had to kind of find your way through to get where you are now. So a lot of your strengths, does it come from this, from the struggles?
I never thought of them as struggles, to be honest. But of course, because when that's your reality, you just think, oh, this is reality. So I never thought of them as struggles until, you know, later on, like now in life when I reflect. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, obviously in Nordrhein-Westfalen and Blankenbach, it's really small towns, right? And we literally were the only Asian family. So I do, one of my main memories is, and maybe this goes back, circles back to the question you asked earlier, like, did my mom instill it in us? But I do remember I would cry because, you know, of course, the classic, all the kids going like, ching, 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 you know, and pulling their eyes back. And I would come home crying. I was quite young, 3-4 years old, you know, so only Kita style. And my mom would say, you know what? Tomorrow you march over there and you push your face forward like this and you go, Mule Maya, Mule Maya, Mule Maya. So,
which are the very common German names.
Which now that I think back on that, I'm
and
like,
you did?
Wow, I did.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
It's
kids
great.
Were like in shock.
No, and it's the right thing to do. There are two ways, you know, you either give in or you fight back. But
yeah.
Obviously you need a lot of strength to fight back. And it's also a lot to ask from a little child, a kindergarten child or a school. I mean, it's already, time is tough enough at that age, you know. And they always find something to pick on.
You 100%.
Can be your culture, your background, you're too tall, you're too short, you're too fat, you're too slim. There's always something.
100%.
And it is a beautiful time, but it's also a horrible time because, and obviously in your situation, it was something where you knew there's nothing you can do apart from fight back. And you could, by being faster than them, you kind of knocked them out. You did the only thing, maybe the only possible thing.
I guess. And you know, now that I'm actually talking about it and reflecting on it, I think maybe my mom probably struggled and was conflicted between being that person, hey, fight back, but also the fact that at that time it really was about acceptance and assimilation was about being that model minority. So I think there was probably like a little bit of clash between that too. I mean, it's tough, you know. I go through the same thing now too. We all do, you know.
Now, actually, we live in a time where these things are, where people talk about it, where we have discussions about it. In the past, I mean, I was born 75. I was lucky. I feel lucky because I always had friends from different cultural backgrounds, and that enriched my life, and that did not allow me to ever feel the way you describe. I always felt it was my normality. And I always felt like this is just enriching my life. But it's obviously, I was on the side that is, I was that white blonde girl. My side, that was much easier than the other kids who had to go through that. And in the end, all you can do is to kind of stick together and fight the fights together. But yeah, there are times when, like you describe, where you are there on your own and you have to fight the fight for yourself.
Yeah. And
which you did.
Of course, when you're young, you don't really realize like what it all means. And, you know, you just kind of, like I said, for me, it would just felt like, oh, it was just my reality, you know. And you asked a question earlier in terms of, you know, did all these, in terms of the struggles. And like I said, I didn't really see them as struggles, except now in retrospect, I do realize, but that's with anyone in life. I do think your experiences, your background, your hair, everything you kind of go through, they all are the building blocks of who you become, right? That's why I just kind of have this model. I never regret anything I do in life because everything that happens, every step you take, every misstep, all of those things are just, you know, and it's so cheesy to say, but they build character, but it actually does, you know? And I realize now, yes, I was this young little Asian kid in Bocholt. And then, you know, when we were quite young, my dad wanted to chase the American dream. So we ended up going to Los Angeles, which obviously is much more diverse and has a huge Korean population. And I just remember, you know, first being the only Asian kid in Bocholt, and then going to Los Angeles, and then I was kind of the only Asian kid amongst Mexicans, because there was no Google Maps, right? So my parents were like, I think this is Koreatown. Anyway, it wasn't, but I only spoke German. So I was the German Asian kid.
You're screwed again.
Always with a bunch of Mexicans. But that was just, like I said, I didn't know that this isn't what other kids went through. You know, it just felt like, okay, this is my life. But you do realize, or I realize now in retrospect, that all of that is kind of, you know, of course, it made me the person that I am. It made me from a very young age think about culture, think about diversity. I've always, you know, living and growing up in Los Angeles, you just live and grow up in a very kind of diverse community. And, you know, what can I say? I think it was from that, because when you have so many different cultures around you, even German culture for me, right? You have this huge kind of, for me, the exploration really was from food, right?
So did you feel, although you were the only Korean girl amongst Mexican kids then, but did you feel relief in the sense of, did you feel like there is diversity that makes, did it make your life easier, that move with 6 years from Germany to California?
Oh, I think so, because all of a sudden it was like, oh, there's, you know, you see other people that look like you. There's other brown kids, you know. And I was always very excited by other cultures and things like that too. So it was exciting.
I mean, all of a sudden there was also much more variety in food because of the diversity. There is food from, I mean, when you go to California and you go to LA, you see food from all over the world. And that's the normality. When you're in Germany and you walk down the street, there are bakeries. They sell bratwurst, sausages somewhere. And it's all very German. Mm-hmm. So did the food, did you already recognize that as a child, that the food scene, or kind of, not the food scene, but that the food around you, that changed?
100%. 100%, but also in a way that I also miss German food too. Oh. And that's maybe the Germanness in me, because I still have such a soft spot. Like, my favorite thing to eat is a schnitzel. I love Sauerbraten. I love having Kaffee and Kuchen. I love my spaghetti eyes. So that part is, I feel like that part is very German in me. But yes, 100%, you know, I still remember just being a kid and just being blown away by the ice cream truck even. The ice cream truck had this mango lollipop, and this is very classic Mexican style, mango lollipop that had chamoy on it, which was like a spicy chili lime salt that they cover on this mango lollipop. And I still remember the first time I had that, it cost 10 cents at the ice cream truck. And it blew my mind at 6 years old.
It feels like ice cream kind of marks the points in your life, you know?
Kind of.
Germany is a spaghetti ice cream.
And then it was a mango.
It's a mango. So let's see when we're going to go further through your life, what comes up next. You mentioned that you liked or loved German food and German traditions like coffee and cake. Sunday, big thing in Germany, Sunday afternoon, people have coffee and cake. It's all very meat-centered, the food here. You have the schnitzel, you have the mm-hmm. sausages, and you missed that. What was the role that Korean food played in your life? Was that the food, I guess, you had in your family? Was that the food that your mother cooked for you? So was that a bit of like a constant, something like to hold on to?
100%. So my mother cooked as much Korean food as she could in Germany. Of course, we were always at an apartment that had like smelly food smells coming out. But
which German apartments have as well. I mean, this is.
I know, that's the thing. I mean, I smell that Sauerbraten when it's cooking.
Exactly. I mean, Sauerkraut also has quite an intense smell.
Absolutely. But, yeah, Korean food always a constant. My dad basically only ate Korean food. He was very like, I need my Korean food. But, you know, I still remember the first, like, eating kimchi when I was a young child, very small toddler, basically. And I see my mom do it with my little niece now, too. So it's really funny, but it's basically you take the kimchi, you cut it up into different strips, you know, and then you wash it in water and then you eat it over rice.
You know that this is how I eat kimchi. I don't kind of cut it in small pieces, but you know that I have to rinse it off very often because it's too spicy for me, and I'm such a baby when it comes to hot and spicy.
Well, just so you know.
So I have the baby kimchi.
That's very traditional in Korea, okay. So good job.
Okay, so I do, apart from the fact that I'm a bit too old for the baby treatment, but I just noticed we totally left out your poor dad, because he was actually, that your dad was the reason why you moved from Germany to LA. He wanted to chase his dreams. So your father one day said, family, I have an idea. Let's go to America.
Yeah, because I do think that was the era. I guess it was the early 80s.
He had lived in America before. Your parents met in Chicago.
In Chicago, yeah. Exactly. He lived in America, but then fell in love with my mom when she visited Chicago and then moved to Germany. But, you know, in the 80s, there was this, you know, aura with America. There was this thing where there was such a thing as the American dream. You know, obviously this generation now, it's a completely different story. But back then, especially for literally anybody that was brown, or probably anyone anywhere else in the world, there was something about America where you felt like it was the land of opportunity, right? And I think my parents really, or my dad really saw America in that way. You know, my dad also came to America under crazy circumstances, just, you know, by winning a lottery. So I think he really thought he could build the future that he imagined from there. And I can see that because, you know, both my parents, especially my dad, you know, you come from like a post-war country, and there's nothing. It's super poor, and there's absolutely nothing. So he really wanted to go to the States. And I think he also really wanted to be with other Korean people.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why we ended up in Los Angeles, yeah.
Did they ever regret that? Or did they feel like, no, I should have said it here because there's no reason to regret. Was it the right step for them? And did they achieve their dream there that they wanted to?
I mean, I think so. Of course. I mean, oh man, I think about my parents worked so hard for us. And it is the classic kind of immigrant story where, you know, your parents work like a bajillion jobs and a bajillion hours to make sure that you have like everything that you could want in the world and to get an education and all of those things. And, you know, they did. They bought like a house, you know, that was built from ground up. And honestly, I look back on my young childhood years and, you know, just every single opportunity that I have is really because of my parents. But I do think that we never talked about it because, you know, obviously we don't talk about things like that. But I do think probably as they got older, and Korea also really grew, like, you know, it's incredible if you think about in the last 60 years how Korea literally went from like war rubble to Samsung. But I think there's a part of not regret but sadness because it was so hard. It was such a struggle to be, you know, an immigrant and to have to fight so hard for everything. But of course they were so happy because they were able to give me and my sister everything. But my dad missed being in Korea and maybe a little bit wished he was still in Korea, but only after it got fancy. And you know, the thing is, my mom really misses being in Germany still to this day.
Really?
100%. She loves Germany. Somehow my mom became German.
How funny.
Yeah, she loves it here.
So she's happy that you're here now?
She loves it. She comes and visits me every year for like 3 months at a time. And I'm always like, oh my God, 3 months. But you know what? She's gone most of the time, visiting all of her friends and doing all those things.
So it really feels like within your family, there are three cultures merged together and they're all very present in different ways. It's German, it's Korean, German and American. And it's so funny that you all pick kind of different, it changed since we know each other more and more, but I always saw you as an American girl. Your mother quite German, your father still very, very Korean in his heart. It's beautiful to see how these three cultures really created their own culture within your family, and all three cultures being very, very different and kind of influencing each other. Did the American food or German food, did that influence your mother's cooking in a way, or is the cooking something that stays very traditional?
We're a Korean house. We always have Korean food. But you know, obviously, and I just want to say, you said it perfectly in terms of how, given the background that I was given, how all of that has really played a role. And we're very German at times, we're very American at times, and we're very Korean at times. But we grew up in a household of mostly Korean food, mostly Korean cooking, which I did not like when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, because of course, kimchi was gross, it was made fun of. Like every other kid, you know, that comes from like a kind of immigrant background, you know, we would go to school and go to elementary school, and all the other kids would have these awesome, amazing, coveted bologna sandwiches, which who knows, I remember it was a bologna sandwich with American cheese that came on Wonder Bread.
And you wanted that.
Kids got that and Doritos. I got a bento box with hot rice, fresh kimchi, marinated soy, Korean beef, sesame spinach, and I was like, I can't believe I have to eat this disgusting crap. All I want is a bologna sandwich.
And who would have thought, I mean, in 2021, I mean, every hipster would have paid a fortune for your bento box.
100%, but as a child,
I think that kids are, in general, we have the word Spießer. They're very traditional. They don't want to stand out really. They
exactly.
Want to have their peace. So everything that looks different, that tastes different, that smells different is something that makes you stand out and gives you attention that maybe at that age you don't really want. So would you have preferred to have a schnitzel in your box?
Oh, that would have been awesome. No, but I think every kid does go through that. And you're right. It's really just a matter of just wanting to fit in, you know, especially when you're a child.
Yes, it's true. So you decided you were 18 to move from LA to New York. How old were you?
So the first kind of move to New York, I have to think about this for a second. 17, 18, 19. And I got accepted into this program to go to New York. And it was an arts program. And I thought, ooh, I'm going to be like a prima ballerina for American Ballet Theater.
That was your dream.
It was kind of my dream. But I definitely wanted to do something in the arts. I was really just loved everything that had to do with theater and the arts and all of that. So then I went to New York and I remember taking ballet classes with the most incredible teachers. I had even this Bob Fosse class with Anne Rankin, who was...
You lived the flash dance dream, flash dance life.
I mean, now...
Young dancer and New York City. I mean, it can't really get better than that.
1,000,000,000%. And I think about some of the teachers that were teaching in this program, and they're like incredibly famous people. But what also happened when I arrived in New York was I really discovered the food culture. I was like, pizza, burgers,
prima ballerina career.
100 billion percent. So food has obviously played such a huge role in my life, right? I mean, you know, like so many people, food really helped carve out my identity. It made me realize who I am, you know, in terms of my heritage and all those things. But, you know, it was also entree into other cultures. So food has always been kind of this constant thing in my life. It has always played a role in not only what I do, but who I am and all those things. And then going to New York and discovering the food culture there was like, that's probably when I realized that this is something that inherently has to be a massive part of my life no matter what. I didn't know how it was going to unfold or any of that, but I just knew that I just want to eat all the food in the world and I want to do something with it.
What fascinates you about food?
I think one of the most important things about food that I think is fascinating and interesting is that it is entree into other cultures. You know, if you travel, the first thing you do to understand, or the first thing you do is put something in your mouth, you eat something, right? And I think food can tell so many different stories about a certain culture. It tells so many stories about migration. It tells so many stories about, I mean, family, community, all of those things. So that's one thing. The second thing that I loved about food and why I just love everything within this kind of gastronomy world is that I do think that it brings people together, right? You have dinner parties, you eat with someone else. And when you sit down and eat with someone, is that's when you share ideas, you share stories. So I think that food kind of can be this amazing connector. So I think those are the two things that I just, if I were to break it down into what it means, those are the two things. But I just love it. I love to eat.
The taste.
I love the taste of food. And I'm still that person that loves, you know, the butter, the fat. I just love the food. So that's one side of it too. And then on the other side, you know, there's, I feel like we've been really lucky in that we have been able to go through the massive evolution that gastronomy has had because, you know, my New York days when I first discovered food, like that time was still, if you worked in a restaurant or if you were, there was no such thing as like a celebrity chef or any of those things. Food was still very, working in food was still very blue collar, right? Whereas literally in the last 20 years, the trajectory of food has been incredible because it has, you know, it's gone from kind of this blue collar, you work in a kitchen kind of thing to, now, if you work in food, you're kind of a celebrity. You're a rock star. You're someone cool. You're someone amazing, you know? So I think it's really interesting to see that trajectory.
Did you like that? The spotlight? The spotlight that that you can have also in food now or in the culinary world?
I don't necessarily think of it as... I'm not into, like, the celebrity...
Well, not the celebrity, but that you have... Also the chances. I mean, a career like mine, a career like yours wouldn't have really been possible, like you just said.
Exactly.
10 years, maybe 20 years ago, definitely not. So it's also through social media and people traveling more, exchanging their experiences, there is a certain attention that you can get now, which wouldn't have been possible 20 years ago.
Absolutely. And 100%. I think that what I really appreciate about the kind of evolution is that I'm just happy that there is more recognition and I'm just happy that there's more respect for what people do. Because, you know, oftentimes if you think about it, things that are like bucketed into like blue collar jobs, you know, those are the jobs that are really blood, sweat, and tears, you know, that nobody really wants to do. Yeah. And let's face it, like working in a kitchen, being a cook, like all those things, it is a blood, sweat, and tears job, 100%. Like, so it's nice that there is some kind of recognition that you can have a career, that we are having conversations around, you know, working those endless, like 100-hour weeks in a hot, sweaty kitchen and all of that. So it's good that this food world or gastronomy world is also kind of blossoming within its own category.
It opened a little bit a door from coming from that hot, sweaty, stinky fried food, whatever place. It opened the door that if you come up, if you have a great idea, if you're hardworking, if you have the qualities right, and if you're lucky, you can get attention, you can get recognition for your work. And that's definitely a new thing. And maybe in a city like New York, you still need a lot of money to achieve that. In a city like Berlin, but we are coming to that later, things are a little bit easier because costs aren't so high and the market isn't so overfed in New York. I remember when I was there, I had been there as a child, but then I hadn't been in a long time. And then in 2016, I was there and I was so overwhelmed by the variety, but also mainly by the quality. I mean, we have the same kind of variety here in Germany, but not that quality level. Wherever you go to in New York or wherever I went to, and I'm not talking about fancy restaurants, food places at every corner, everything was of such exceptional quality. Mm-hmm. And that really, that touched me, it impressed me and intimidated me also. We spoke about that in America. In New York, people work so hard to reach the top quality level. Mm-hmm. And you feel if you don't do that, then you're out.
Yeah.
You're out. You're actually in America, you're out of the whole system because you're out of the flat, you're out
sadly,
of the health,
yes.
health
sadly, yes.
insurance in America,
yes,
you're
yes,
literally
yes.
out. So did you ever feel when you lived in New York and you got into food, through your jobs, did you ever feel scared or intimidated by it? Or did you feel like, I love it, I'm going to conquer it, I'm going to make it?
So a little bit of both. I knew that one day I was going to do something in gastronomy for sure. But I also struggled with the fact that, you know, I still have Korean parents and I did not play the violin or the piano, so I better get a freaking good adult, grown-up, respectable job.
Yeah. So you felt
that was not being a cook in a kitchen.
So you felt family pressure, even if it was not them saying it, but you within yourself felt like, I'm going to prove it.
They said it too.
Okay. There was pressure.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not even that there was pressure, because I think my mom has always been super supportive, but it was self-pressure too, because I also didn't know at that time. We're talking 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago. It was still the beginning of gastronomy, and I still didn't know where or what my role could be in gastronomy. The only thing I knew at that time was, you know, of course, I've been working in restaurants since I was 16 years old. First at Ruby's Diner, where I wore this little candy striper outfit, and so I've always had that. So I always knew that there was this restaurant world or culinary world, but it was always kind of as like my job as a server or whatever, or a bartender at this other place that I worked. But I still didn't know at that time exactly how it would all unfold, but I knew that I had to be, you know, a good Korean, you know, daughter of immigrants and get a respectable job, which is why I became I didn't become a consultant. Yeah, I guess, yeah.
You were a consultant.
I was a consultant. I'm still a consultant. And I kind of did that consulting job. But like I said earlier, no regrets, because it's just crazy, because now where I am today in terms of, you know, working in a bar, having a bar, all those things, everything that has to do with the bar, everything that has to do with cooking, so much of that skill set I learned from being a consultant. You know what I mean? Whether it's, you know, all the back-end office stuff, the marketing, all of that plays such a huge role in where I am today. The ballet still plays a massive role in what I do today, because of the ballet and all of that, I can stand up straight in a kitchen. I can stand on my feet for 12, 14 hours a day. So it's really interesting on how...
Discipline, I mean...
The discipline, 100%. Yeah. It all plays a role, even though they seem to be from such far out different worlds.
It feels like, and that's why It's an interesting thing of talking to people in their 40s then, because then you kind of put all the puzzle pieces together. Wow. And it feels like all of a sudden you see all the little bricks that you collected, that you built throughout your life, and it's becoming this wall, this house, whatever. And you see that every little brick, how no matter how unimportant it felt when you shaped it, but now it becomes that solid part of the house that you are. And I find this so interesting to see also with people like you who come from or who've lived in different countries, worked in different fields, and nothing is wasted. Everything you've done, everything you've experienced is a part of course, who you are as a person now, but what we're coming to later is a part of your business. Like even the shittiest jobs one I did in my life, I learned so much from this. And that's why I find that people who've done a lot of different things have often a more complex, a very complex personality and also a skill set to adapt maybe then to different situations and to just pull out a new project and to make that work. So you mentioned you worked in the fields of marketing consulting in New York. What was the point for you when you felt like this is a nice, respectable job and my parents are maybe proud of me and I live in New York and I have a nice flat, whatever. When did you feel like, no, that's not it. Now I want something else.
I mean, I always knew that, you know, I always was like, this is not it, but I also was in it. You know, when you're in New York, well, you have to be, right? When you're in New York, you're in your job and you are just doing the hustle, and it was the work hard, play hard. And I see it now too, in retrospect. You know, I would work a bajillion hours, get screamed at all day, hustle out my PowerPoints, do all those things. And I would be like, you know, doing presentations and all that. And then in the evening, I would go have the most fabulous, like, dinners. You know, I would, you know, part of being a consultant was taking clients out. So we were doing, you know, I was in my 20s, mind you, and we were, you know, doing dinners every week at Gramercy Tavern or like Danielle, these like amazing, mind-blowing restaurants. So in a way, even though I was in consulting, it still allowed me to explore and discover food. I mean, we would dine at 11 Madison Park, you know, on a Wednesday night. I mean, that's
why did insane. You leave that life?
Insane. Well, exactly. I mean, but then the more I was exposed to these amazing places, the more I loved it too. The more I wanted to be a part of that somehow. So,
did you ever consider creating something like what you've created here in Berlin now to do that in New York, or was it not just about I want to get out of that consultancy job and I want to work maybe in the food of field in the field of food? Was it important for you to change the city again?
I don't think I consciously knew that at that time, but again, hindsight's always 20/20. But I think it did take the move to give me the courage to do it, or not even the courage, but more the opportunity, I would say.
So when did you decide to go to Berlin?
So in 2000, so I've been in Berlin 11 years now. So 2010, I started doing a consulting project with Baya here, actually. And it was a really incredible project because it was about women's health and women's health in EMEA and how do you like educate women on health and all those things. So completely kind of different area, but it did bring me out to Berlin, and it was for a project. So I still remember the summer. I was here for the summer, of course, best time to fall in love with Berlin.
You should never come in winter.
Never. Yeah. My whole story could have been different if I came in the winter.
Would have left.
But I came to Berlin, and it was a very easy project for me to sign on to because I still had that kind of love for Germany, right? That has always been with me. And, you know, even as a child, we came back to Germany every summer and spent time with the German family, if you will. And I still remember the moment. I was drinking an Aperol Spritz, and this is 11 years ago. I'm American. I don't even know what Aperol is. all I knew was amazing. My first Aperol Spritz, I was like, whoa.
You decided, I'm going to stay.
This is amazing. And I was a Bar 25. Do you remember Bar 25 on the Spree?
Yes,
it was
way
before.
Yes.
And I was at Bar 25 and there was a swing on this tree.
Yeah.
And I was swinging on that swing over the Spree, drinking an Aperol Spritz. And I was like, I'm staying.
Okay, Berlin made it easy for you.
It was Aperol Spritz. No,
swinging
I'm kidding.
Over the river.
Yeah, and it was gorgeous. It was just one of those perfect, beautiful summer days.
But Berlin summers are a bit of, it feels like they're endless student summer, you know? It's like when, during Berlin summer, I feel so often reminded of how I felt as a teenager during the summer times, because everything feels light and easy
there
and
is,
fun.
Yeah.
And there is a very nice... Someone, a Mediterranean person, actually told me that Berlin feels a bit Mediterranean, like a piece of the Mediterranean in within Germany. It doesn't feel like Germany, actually. So you decided to stay. You decided to do something with food because you did pop-up dinners in the beginning. You didn't do anything with drinks, or?
Didn't do anything with drinks. I just drank them.
You just drank them, yeah.
A lot of them.
And seeing that there wasn't good Korean food, you said,
I'm just going to drink instead. No.
No. You created Korean food. Because you did the pop-up dinners with Korean food, didn't you?
I did. So basically what happened was this opportunity came up, kind of spurred them on. And I like the spontaneous. I'm a very go-for-it kind of person. And an opportunity came up at Street Food Thursday, which is now the famous street food market at Magdalen Neun. And this is now 6-7 years ago already. And an opportunity came to have a stand, I don't know, someone pulled out or whatever, for one night. And I was like, yes, I'll do it. And within like 48 hours, I got a GBR, I got my Rote Karte, I did all of like the crazy
paperwork.
So you
did all the legal work to be allowed to start a company?
Yeah, absolutely.
Whoa, you're quick.
Within I just made it happen. And that's the thing, like I think it's hard. Like a lot of people, myself included, we complain about the freaking bureaucracy and paperwork because it is insane. Literally the other day, one of the amps wanted me to fax something to them. And I was like, oh my God, now I have to go on Amazon and see if they even sell fax machines. No. But it's just what it feels like here. But I made it happen. And then I had the stand. And then we were asked to stick around. And then long story short, I started regularly doing Street Food Thursday. And really the basis of that food, again, was my upbringing, right?
Yeah.
So did things like Korean tacos, a Korean version of the ramen, and honestly, at that time, it was just this thing I wanted to try. I didn't know that it would snowball so fast, you know, which is amazing, right? Like, I do feel very grateful. All happened very organically. But yeah, so basically, the winter came around, and I was doing this kind of Korean version of a ramen. And it happened to be at this time when Berlinale wanted to also do a street food thing. And then we were asked to do the Korean ramen at Berlinale. And I remember hand-making noodles. and that's just really the moment where I was like, okay. It's time to jump ship.
Yeah.
It's time to hang up the PowerPoint and pick up the knife kind of thing. And that basically was the beginning. And then... It did. It just kind of all snowballed, you know, from doing contracts with Berlinale to like Fashion Week. So there was a lot of cooking and street food style cooking involved. And it was a huge learning process for me. It was like, it was hardcore, you know, I just went from zero to 360 degree move. And
but you were welcomed with open arms, but everything seemed, it seems like that everything worked out very, very smoothly. Which maybe because you made the right choices, because I think if there aren't many obstacles, it's like it has to happen. Destiny tells you this is the right thing. Just keep walking.
Which
is basically what you did.
Yeah.
I just kept doing it.
Exactly. And I think you're absolutely right. And I think timing does have something to do with it.
You came it was a great time.
It
because
was a great
Berlin
time.
Was hungry for good food, for new food, for different experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And if you did something with great quality, people, yeah, they just welcomed you with open arms.
It was. Honestly, it was a really good time. And it was a really good time for me to also... It does. You know, it seems and looks like a fairy tale story. But, you know, as you know, anything in gastronomy is a complete nightmare.
It's hard work. Above all, it's very hard work.
The hardest thing you will ever do in life. And, you know, you see so many interviews with, like, fancy chefs and whatever. And they always say, don't do it. Don't ever get into this business. It's crazy. It's long hours. Don't ever do it. You become a chef, and then all of a sudden you have your own restaurant. You're not cooking anymore. You're just, you know, you're just like drowning with your bills and your Excel sheets or whatever. And all that's true.
But still, But
that's the thing. I mean, people do it because they love it, ultimately, at the end of the day. You have to love this job. You really do.
One of the things that, for me, it describes your character so much is, so one night we went out together and we stayed out quite late and we drank too much. I felt horrible for 2 days. And you actually, that next day, reopened your bar after lockdown. And you didn't just tell your husband to throw the cocktails together. You actually stood in the kitchen and you cooked because he had food that day.
Or
it was an event. And the whole day I was thinking, how does she manage this? How does she manage to stand in that state, hungover, stand in the kitchen, opening her restaurant? And that impressed me so much.
Really?
Because I'm sure you looked as gorgeous as you look now. I'm sure no one would have thought that you had too much alcohol the night before. And if you had seen me, you could definitely... My neighbor actually asked, you drank too much last night. And that shows, that is Susan for me.
Wow.
You are so determined, so hardworking, and you just pull it together and there's no complaining. But you also, which impressed me, you don't miss the party the night before. Because a lot of people would have put on a facial mask and just gone to bed at 10. No, what do? You stay out until 2 or 3 in the morning with me and drink too much and still open your bar. And it's a success. And it fits... So it kind of, this is everything you describes now explains why you are the person who sits in front of me now. And you don't have to look shy now.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about, you know what it actually goes back to is Auntie Mame. Life's a feast and most sons of bitches are starving to death. And I just,
It comes back.
I'm like, you only live once. It's so cheesy, that whole, like, you only live once, no, live for today.
It's a freaking truth. I mean, you do only live once, and it's up to you if it's a party and opening your business the next day, or if it's neither a party nor opening your business.
Yeah,
it's a
100%.
Choice. It's a lot of work, and it's tough. So when did you decide to leave the food behind and get into drinks?
So I've always been into drinks too.
I believe 100%.
That strawberry margarita. I blame the strawberry margarita. No, so of course, along with going to these amazing restaurants in New York, you also discover and again, it's timing, right? Because when I was in New York was really the beginning of this amazing kind of cocktail scene came to life in New York. And very much like we were talking about the food trajectory, you know, going from, you know, a certain level and state of being, that obviously food trajectory has grown. I think the bar cocktail scene is following the same. You know, you have like star tenders now and like all those things, right?
Although Berlin always had quite a few good bars. I can imagine that it's a bit of a tougher field than food, because with food there wasn't much competition because the quality was just so bad. With drinks, I don't know how the situation is now, but I remember even like 20 years ago, there were always good bars here.
Yeah.
So you had to know your shit, basically. You couldn't just say, I'm going to mix something together. What gave you the confidence to say, I'm going to get into this market with a bar?
I feel like I've done a lot of research.
drinking.
I remember, so the thing is, there was this time in New York, because, you know, as a consultant, like I said, you're always going out with clients or going out with your team all the time. And New York is just a plethora of amazing places to go to. And like I said, you know, cocktails had just really started to come alive then. And I remember I went to this place called Pegu Club. And Pegu Club was also run at that time by a woman, which I thought was also really cool, incredible. Audrey Saunders is, I think, her name. Yeah, it is. I don't know why I'm saying I think. I'm like, idolize her. But no, but I remember I had a daiquiri for the first time, like just a classic daiquiri. And I just couldn't believe it. I was just like, wow, this drink is amazing. And what is it about this drink that makes it amazing? And that really was the first entree where I started thinking about, you know, the same way as a cook, you look at, you know, your base kind of vegetables or your poultry or meat, all of that. It kind of, I started realizing there's a lot of parallels, right? You look at your rums, you look at your whiskeys, you look at all those things. And very much from a flavor profile perspective, you can break down flavor profiles that you do with food the same way that you do with drink. And I didn't know anything, you know, I didn't know the difference between like a rum agricole and a regular rum and a aged rum, whatever. I didn't know any of that. But what I realized, it's really kind of the same mindset, right? So one is just a breakdown of flavor and thinking about flavor. The second thing is also, you know, which we talk a lot about now, where does it come from, right? You think about the same thing in spirits, you know, where does it come from? You know, is it organic? Is the sugarcane organic? How do they treat their workers? You know, what does the farm look like? All those things. So that was the other thing. And then what I realized with that daiquiri too, the reason why it was so darn good was because it was perfectly balanced. Mm. And then I thought, wow, it's the same thing with food, right? So even though I love to eat, I love to drink, I cook, and I did bartend in my college years, all those things, you know, the more mature your palate gets and more mature you get, I started thinking about it in that way. And I think that was kind of one of the first moments where I thought, oh, this cocktail thing, you know, this is really cool. So that's where it started. And then, I don't know, I think when I was in Berlin, because as you mentioned, there were such amazing cocktail bars. I mean, I was like, I thought Buck and Breck was my living room. Buck and Breck was my living room the first, I don't know, 7 years I was here. And I just knew that one day, if I were to do something, it would have to have amazing cocktails, but also amazing food.
Yeah.
Like I wanted to bring that place here that was doing great cocktails, but also still fun, because I still think ultimately with everything in food, everything in drink, I'm still a firm believer that it all boils down to hospitality. So that's kind of always first, but I think at that time I felt like I was really excited to explore what you could do with cocktails the same way that I thought about and explored food.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
What, there is something very vibrant about your character. And what I love is I can see it's there in the way you talk, in the way you dress. It's in the way your bar looks. I love the colors in your bar. I love that you have this golden palm tree. It's very classy, but you see, you love life. You have a lust for life, zest for you. There's this hunger for life, and you love, like you said, you love this fun, having fun. It feels like whatever you do is 100% Susan. There's really like you're alive. You're happy that you're alive. You enjoy it, and you're just gonna have a good time. And this comes through in really everything you do. Like I really really love your pictures on Instagram, and I don't really enjoy Instagram so much anymore because everything looks the same. But whenever, I think that was one of the first things that drew me to you, these pictures, and you take them yourself, and they're full of color, but they're still, it's again, it's well balanced. But the visual aspect of it is so strong, which is when I had then the first cocktails at your bar, it was a very visual experience. How important is that with, I mean, it's important with food as well, but it feels like it has a bit of a different touch with drinks, with cocktails. What is the meaning of that visual aspect in a cocktail?
So the first thing, it means a lot to me that you notice that. It does, because there's so in terms of where we are in the cocktail world, I mean, it's also really grown a lot, matured a lot, and, you know, there's really like fancy mixologists and all those things, if you will. But what's, to me, why did I open this place? Why do I have this place? I really enjoy life. I do. I'm a annoyingly positive person. It's just me. But I do. Like, I feel like I want to be able to share joy, right? And that really is the first thing with this bar. It looks the way it does because I want people to be happy there. I want people to have fun there. And I want people to find joy there. And it's the same thing with drinks, because I can't do much to change the world, really. But what I can do is give a moment of pleasure, a moment of joy, a moment of fun. And I think that is something we so desperately need nowadays. And I think that I feel that I know how to do that with a drink, you know, or with a plate of food, right? And when you, I don't want to call it a responsibility, but when you have that pleasure, if you will, you want it to be, you want to make the best out of, you want to give that to someone.
You want, to share
you want it.
It
to look
you want to
great.
Share.
You want it to make someone go, ah, you know, or like, wee, or like, oh my God, it's so beautiful.
No, because you create that within other people, and that is extremely satisfying. I love cooking, I love eating, and it's nice to do that for myself, but it's, I can't compare it to when I do that for other people and I see their happy face. It sounds like a cliche too, but it's true. It is, all these things only work with sharing. This, the eating, drinking, everything we're talking about, it's just about sharing, and that's where the satisfaction point then comes from. And I mean, I went to your bar and I didn't even want to drink anything, and in the end I did drink, and in the end I did feel so, just by seeing this drink, I mean, obviously tasting it as well, it just makes you feel good. And it's not the alcohol. It's before the alcohol kicks in, I already feel happy. Like the first drink I had there, I forgot its name, but it's actually, the inspiration came from a picture that you showed me that you took in California at the coast. And it was this blue, like steel blue colored coast, the black rocks at the beach, and the white foam on top of the sea. And you showed that to your husband, who, we're always leaving out the guys here kind of.
That's
today.
Okay.
Your husband, who you met through in your bar, and you're married now, and he's the bartender in your, or mixologist in your bar. So you showed him, I guess, this picture and told him,
Let's do a drink
that looks like this, and he freaking, or you together, did it, and it did look like this picture, and it was also, I mean, first of all, it was Blue Curaçao, which I haven't drunk in...
So 80s.
But
it's, who
also
cares?
That, it's also a color where you feel like, shall I drink that? But it was so good, and then it had the black, you kind of imitated the black...
Sand
with rock...
With sea salt. Yeah.
And you did that fancy foam thing on top. And it was just, I felt like a child. It was just fun to hear the story, to see it, to drink it. Yeah, there is I think that maybe that's the thing with cocktails, at least for me. It has a bit of a playfulness. It should have playfulness.
Yeah.
Then I can have a whiskey or something at a fireplace in an old British bar.
What?
But if I want a cocktail, then I want to be entertained.
Yeah.
I want to have fun. I want to see the golden palm tree and the fancy funny drink with that story. And you do that perfectly.
Thank you.
It's where else do you find inspiration for the drinks, both of you?
Everything. So the menu that we have right now is a very California-focused menu. I'm from California. We just did a trip to California. And I decided the second I was in Cali that I wanted to develop drinks based off experiences that we have in California. And that literally is our menu right now. So for example, the drink that you mentioned is called PCH because we were driving down PCH. I took this picture and I thought, you know what? This is so beautiful. It's a drink. I can taste this right now. So that really was the inspiration. Old Place Bellini is literally named after this amazing place in the like the mountains of Malibu, called the Old Place, and I had this amazing blackberry Bellini there. So this particular menu is specifically inspired from, you know, California, but also this specifically this trip. In terms of where I get my inspiration from, it's...
You just walk through life with open eyes. That's how it feels.
100%. And I feel like you can have so much creativity and fun, which is really an important piece in my life. I need to be creative. Also sounds so weird saying that, cheesy, but...
No, not at all.
No, but you know, I think like what I've been thinking about lately, and let's see how this comes to fruition, but I thought, you know, the next thing I want to do with a menu is I want to develop drinks based off of my friends, like their personalities. So I have, you know, so many amazing women in my life, besties, so many amazing people in my life, so many interesting, spectacular bar guests. And I thought, what would a drink be, you know, if this person was a drink?
This is great.
So things like that, you know, I just think it's, you know, on one hand, it's fun. Again, you know, it's fun. On the other hand, it's creative expression. And it's just a fun way to work.
It feels like it's not really hard work for you to come up with these ideas. It doesn't even feel like you're sitting down with your husband and saying like, oh, we need a new concept or whatever. It feels like these things, they just come to you, or you're receptive enough to notice when they come to you.
I mean, I have like a billion ideas that I want to do, you know, and that's the great thing about having your own place, right? And I'll tell you, like, it's been open 3.5 years now, and the first years were really tough. They were just really tough growing pains, you know, in so many ways. But even after Corona, or not after, I guess we're still in Corona, you know, number one, that we're still there is amazing. But I actually finally feel like the bar is literally the place that I imagined it to be, the place that I dreamed it to be. So of course you have all your growing pains, everybody does. But I do, I really feel like this is exactly what I pictured, which is so cool, you know? I feel so lucky to have that.
So you had this vision for this place, and you now it's there.
Oh my gosh.
And it's in my city, which is freaking amazing. I mean, I would visit you in New York or in LA or wherever, or in Bocholt.
That's next, though.
Bocholt is the next step, next level. But I'm absolutely happy that you have this here now. Every guest shares a recipe on this podcast, which is then on my blog on maikepeters.com under Meet in Your Kitchen. And you offered to share the recipe for your kimchi margarita. How did you come up? Did you just have a margarita and you ate kimchi? And you said, that works. No, actually, this is how flavors often come together, that you just have two flavors together and you feel like that actually fits.
So, again, back to the whole, you know, just like with food, obviously Korean, being Korean is a huge part of my heritage and my background, but I the kimchi margarita has become our signature cocktail. So there's two, actually, the kimchi margarita and the kimchi michelada. And maybe, I don't know, we can discuss it after this. Maybe we do both.
What's the name? The second one, how's it called?
So it's a kimchi michelada, mm-hmm. Which is also, it literally, this drink is like my full heritage in a way, my entire, my family background. It's, So first with the kimchi margarita, it's just this thing where we also make kimchi at the bar. We sell jarred kimchi, and you always find that you have a lot of juice left over, and throwing away the juice is, you would never do that. It's this gold, you know, that usually you cook with or make a soup out with or whatever. And there was just this one point where I just thought, I mean, kimchi juice would be amazing. It's amazing in a Bloody Mary. People are already experimenting with it. And then we have this mezcal that we work with that is fantastic. You taste the mezcal and you think, oh my God, the kimchi juice is just gonna be this amazing deliciousness. I just know it. And it just ended up being amazing deliciousness. And then it just ends up being your signature drink, right? But the drink that came before that, the first time I used kimchi, was in a michelada. So traditionally, in Mexico, a michelada is beer with some kind of tomato concoction. So it's like their version of it's almost like a Bloody Mary, how we drink in America, but in Mexico you drink a michelada. So beer with like a tomato something, sometimes it's clamato. And then I thought, well, kimchi and tomato go amazingly well together. I love using kimchi in other kinds of cooking. So like a kimchi bolognese or a kimchi lasagna, kimchi mac and cheese, all those things. So basically made...
This is where the American comes through.
Totally.
Because for me, this is American. Americans are like, this is great from the taste I had here. And then I tasted this. It doesn't matter if it's sweet, sour, spicy, whatever. If it's German, Korean... Italian, it doesn't matter where it comes from. There is this playfulness and this openness to just throw things together. And I always saw this as something very beautiful. I know that there are big discussions at the moment, which are totally, it's important to have these discussions
100%.
Because you can't take food away from cultures, and you have to, I think it's important to like with Italian food, we always have the Italian culture in mind, and it's important that we have that with every other food as well. But the mixing of flavors or of certain components of different cultures is something I learned to love in America.
I mean, I think if you do it with the right intention and if you do it right, if you do it respectfully, 100%, I think it's great, to be honest. And, you know, like I mentioned, it's really the michelada and the margarita are an expression of basically how I grew up, you know. Right, so back to the michelada, basically. But to make it fun, because I'm all about fun. But the michelada, we do fresh kimchi juice and a tomato base with like soy and Worcester and lime, and we make a popsicle. So that's really fun, right? So the popsicle then goes into the beer glass, and then you pour the beer into the beer glass, and then the popsicle kind of melts. You can take a bite of the popsicle. So that's been around since day one for us too. And it's interesting because that whole drink, I do think, and the kimchi margarita too, I think it really kind of captures who we are as a bar.
I can't wait to try that. I haven't tried it yet, but I can't wait to try that. And I love it that even, like I said before, everything you do is Susan unfiltered. So the drink, whatever drink we're going to choose now for the vlog, it is Susan unfiltered. Before we're coming to the last 10 questions now, we're going to do something very, very German, a German tradition of the Frühschoppen, of drinking before noon, although we're a little bit late and it's past noon. But we're going to have a little Frühschoppen now. And may I ask you to get the Spumante out of the fridge? We have wonderful Spumante from Ferrari Trento.
Ooh.
And wait.
See, this is the ballet.
You see, you can use everything in life, even the ballet classes.
Ooh.
There it is.
This
shall
is
I
exciting.
Open it? Would you like to open it?
Do you want
it?
To open it?
I don't mind.
Sure.
Okay. Careful. So, we haven't spoken about your poor husband. How does it feel to
that's
work
okay.
with... That's okay. But how does it feel to work with your husband in the bar? Because you are such a team.
We are.
Whenever I see you two together, it feels like you don't even need to talk.
We're just like, I don't know what it is. And I think we have really huge professional respect for each other.
Yeah.
Number one. So when we're at the bar, we're very professional. But it also helps that, you know, we just really know each other really well.
Yeah.
And it's really fun. I know most people are like, you can't work and live together. You can't, you know, work with your boyfriend or partner or whatnot. But I completely disagree with
that. I think
that.
It comes down to respect and to giving each other space.
100%.
It's like with cooking. I always think when you cook with someone else, one is the chef, the other one is the sous chef, and the sous chef just accepts what the chef decides. And the roles can change, but you can't have two chefs working together at the same time.
I think that's exactly what it is, because we share the responsibility in terms of like, you know, there's loads of responsibilities with any kind of place, right? So that's one thing, but we do have very specific areas that we own.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, we kind of, you know, there are shifts where he just owns the service and that's just his thing then, you know?
Yeah.
And there are shifts where I do the bar, but that's my thing.
Yeah.
You know, so there it's like you said, it's the professional respect ultimately.
So I'm doing something here now because I thought when Susan comes to my kitchen, I can't just offer her spumante. Let's see. But I'm not really a cocktail person. But what I love when I don't know what to choose in a bar is I always go for champagne with strawberries.
Yay!
So I hope you don't mind. I'm
going to
throw some strawberries into your spumante now, and I'm going to call it a cocktail.
Yeah! Wow, it's beautiful.
That's as wild as it gets in my kitchen. Oh, wait.
Perfect. God. You did it.
Yeah, I did it. You know what my aunt, hello Gisela, told me once, and she said, no, it doesn't work. She said, put the finger in.
Oh.
So if your bubbles bubble up, I didn't reach the liquid now.
Actually.
She said, put the finger in, but you have to actually reach the liquid, which I didn't do now.
Well, it looks beautiful. I'm so excited.
We have to give it a name.
Is today Monday? No, it's Tuesday. What is today?
Monday.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
This is the way to Monday.
It's the Happy Monday. It's a cheesy name, but we call it the Happy Monday.
The Happy Monday. Cheers.
Very nice. Not very nice. I'm so happy that you're here on the Meet in My Kitchen podcast. And I mean, the first time I met you, I knew we were going to have fun, but I didn't know it would be so interesting, so inspiring, so also, I feels like how I experienced you the first time we met is really who you are. You are meeting Susan once is meeting Susan or seeing the Susan who you truly are, which is really, I'm very happy you came into my life and you came to this podcast. So now we're going to do the last 10 questions. Favorite cocktail?
Daiquiri? That's hard. Today I'm saying daiquiri because it's the first thing that came to my mind.
On Monday it's a daiquiri.
Okay.
Best bar in the world apart from your own.
So honestly, I have such mad, huge, crazy respect for Mr. Lion, who has a bar in London called Lioness. It formerly was Dandelion. And then he has several other bars because he's fabulous. But for me, it's just... His everything is the best. I think his politics are amazing and his bar is amazing and his drinks are amazing. And it was a huge inspiration for me going for it and opening Mr. Susan.
Favorite Korean food, favorite German food? Although you answered the German food already, but.
So I love a schnitzel.
Yep.
Any day, every day.
And favorite Korean food?
That's really hard, but honestly, when it comes down to it, just a hot bowl of amazing rice with just delicious kimchi. Simple.
Best business advice you ever got?
Know your worth.
If your mother offered to cook a meal for you tonight, what would you ask her to cook for you?
Oh, you know, it's crazy. It's called gongnam-eunbap, which basically translates to bean sprout rice. It sounds so basic and I don't know. But my mom just has this way of cooking perfect rice with mung bean sprouts, which you can't get here. It's the one with like a yellow bean. With kimchi and some delicious bulgogi that's just like steamed together to perfection. And the way that she cooks it, there's always that crispy bottom on that rice, which is like the coveted piece. So that is literally my mom dish that I love.
Best part of living in LA, New York, Berlin, each city. If you have to, in one word, quick sentence, each city.
So LA is family. New York is the hustle. Berlin is opportunity.
What do you cook for your husband on a date night, or what does he cook for you on a date night?
So the really fun thing is we love to cook together, which is fun. We just got a green egg, which is crazy. So we do a lot of cooking together, but I mostly handle the Korean stuff. And because he has Dutch background, he does a lot of kind of Dutch, Indonesian, Suriname style.
What would you recommend to a person like me who is always overwhelmed when she goes to a bar? I'm really overwhelmed by the menu at a bar, not at a restaurant, just in bars, and I'm totally indecisive. And I never know. That's why I often end up drinking champagne with strawberries, because I'm overwhelmed.
You know, honestly, and of course, people always when they come to the bar, are like, I don't know what to get. And the first thing I always say, well, what's your vibe? What's your feeling? Like, are you feeling like you want to go for more of a fresh, fun vibe, or you know, is it like a fireplace and a leather chair kind of vibe? So that's one thing I like to ask. But honestly, the way that I kind of got to my favorite too, like I love a margarita, just straight up margarita, you know, things like that. I mean, and not straight up. I love a margarita on the rocks, by the way. but I think it's now for someone like yourself as well, is to think about like what liquors you like. Like, do you love gin? Do you love rum, you know, and kind of exploring the flavors of the spirits? And then just starting with the classics, because that's how I really learned, right? Because then you turn, you know, like with gin, for example, you can, oh, I love a gin martini, you know, that's a very like New York thing. But then you realize, okay, there's the gin tonic, but then you can also have a gin sour. You can also, you know, I think it's maybe starting with the base spirit. Yeah. And thinking about if you like that base spirit.
Yeah.
Because that will always guide you in terms of what to order on a drink, you know.
If I want to start a little bar at home, what are the basics I should, the spirits I should invest in? What should everyone have at home in the bar?
So I think, well, you should just have a really nice whiskey. Mm-hmm. You should have a great gin that you love, you know, just a gin that you really like drinking, whether it's more citrus or floral or junipery.
Yeah.
You should have a nice rum, I guess, would be the other basic spirit. And I don't know, I'm personally a huge mezcal fan, so I feel like you should have a bottle of mezcal. But so other than like having your amazing spirits, I think really what changes your home bar and having a great home bar is just fresh ingredients. So always having fresh citrus, for example, I think is always the best thing. And, you know, having your homemade simple syrup, you know, I feel
and
like
ice cubes.
And then exactly. And then ice. I really think it's, you know, you have your great spirits, but it's really about the other stuff, like the ice, the glassware that you love. I feel like that's such a part of it too,
that is,
you know?
No, I totally agree. And I love it that this is so celebrated in the bar world more than in the food world. And yes, fancy restaurants have fancy plates and so on. But it feels like with drinks, each drink has its glass. Each wine has, each grape has its glass. And I love that about drinks.
It's fun. I mean, especially after a Corona year, you know, where you're really thinking about your at-home life more.
It's time to invest in glasses.
I mean, you know, I think all those things make home bar an experience.
Yeah. What's the meaning of food for you?
I would say in a nutshell, it's community. So for me, for example, through COVID, really the food world really kind of banded together, supported each other. So that's one way of community. The other way is, you know, again, heritage, how it brings you closer to your heritage. Again, community. And you can really build community, like friends, you know, around a dinner table. You're also building community that way. So I think that's food in a nutshell.
Susan, thank you so much for visiting me in my kitchen and being a guest of the Meet in My Kitchen podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled.
I hope you look forward to the next episode of Meet in My Kitchen just as much as I do. Until then, you can find all the recipes of my guests and also the impressions and pictures from my visits at their kitchens on maikepeters.com. On Instagram, you can follow the podcast at Meet in My Kitchen Podcast, one word, and you can follow me at Eat in My Kitchen. I'm Maike. Thank you for listening and keep on cooking.